Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we take a break from Spokane City Council and mayoral candidate interviews to talk about state government. Sometimes after legislative sessions end, state representatives and senators will do tours in their district and share what happened with constituents and reporters. Today, Representatives Jenny Graham and Mike Voltz from the 6th District are in our studio to give their perspectives about the session. We talk about education funding, about ghost bills, and other topics. Mike Voltz is a Republican in his second term. Jenny Graham is a Republican in her first term.
My first session was definitely a learning curve, but really awesome. I had an opportunity to meet a lot of really talented people on both sides of the aisle, and I had an opportunity to work on relationships, get to know them. I think that it was nice that I could take legislation and not only go to people that are on, you know, on the Republican caucus, but take legislation and go to the Democrat caucus as well to say, what do you think about this? You know, what are the pros? What are the cons? What's on your mind? And we really did work a lot to come to work on compromises.
So did you find, were there any real surprises for you?
The good surprises were all of the really nice legislation that we were able to work on together and get through in a bipartisan way. And there's a whole list. I mean, there's a lot. I think the thing that was surprising for me in not as good of a way, and something that is concerning to me, are the ghost bills, the title-only bills, and going through that process, recognizing that there were 26 of them that were introduced and 4 of them passed. And, you know, a title-only bill is just what that is. It's just a title. There's no body to it. And in that process, there's supposed to be a 10-day period that allows the public to weigh in on that and have a hearing, but that didn't happen. These came through at the last minute with no body and in the middle of the night, and the people were locked out of the house for a couple of the days, and that to me was surprising. It doesn't matter to me if you're a Democrat or Republican, that should not be happening.
Yeah, so the way the process worked is on a couple of these bills, they would have a title-only bill that would drop. It would be rammed into a committee in the morning where they would add an amendment in the morning that would add the language. And then sometime, you know, around midnight or so, or after midnight, literally in the dead of the night, we would vote on final passage off the House floor. It moved that quickly, and no time for amendment. There was really no time in the process for the citizens or the stakeholders even analyze what the bill meant to their household or their business or their whatever group or organization. So they moved through really quickly. I agree, it was very frustrating. I didn't see that in the last 2 years that I was there. So this was a new and wonderful thing. Well, wonderful being sarcastic, but a new development in it. And I think I agree with Jenny that it's completely inappropriate. And I would hope that if we were ever in the majority, we would not do that. And I would not tolerate it from my party, any party on it. So I would vote no on mere principle. It could be my favorite bill of all time. And if that's the process, I would vote no just on that alone on the bill, and would rail against it because of the process.
So, okay, so we've talked about ghost bills. Let me ask you to characterize the bill from your point of, or I'm sorry, the session from your point of view.
I would say it was frustrating. I think there was a lot of good work done early on. There was a lot of involvement. There was a lot of bipartisan bills ranging from from license plate bills to K-12 reform on alternate pathways for students to graduate. And then at the very end, when we don't see the budget, you know, which is our kind of our key thing that we're supposed to be doing over there doing the budget, we don't see the budget till, what was it, the 104th day in session.
Out of 105.
Yeah. And we finally see the budget, and then we get all these ghost bills to pay for the spending in the budget. Well, there's no there's no way in God's green earth that we're going to be able to digest that. And I left there very, very frustrated and disappointed over really the last week of the session. And you know, we go over there and there's 98 people from all corners of the state. We're not going to agree on everything, and that's fine, and it should be good and healthy. But the way that ended was neither good nor healthy, and was, in my opinion, absolutely disrespectful to the citizens and the process.
So I just want to ask about K-12 spending. We have a lot of school districts here who are struggling. They've had to have hearings about we're having to lay off teachers and other. Can you explain what has, to people who haven't been following this, what's happening here?
So what's happened is you have to really look at there's two parts of this. There's the state funding and the state responsibility, and then there's the local decision making. And so from the state funding perspective, and 2018 was kind of an anomaly year. It was higher funding than what it would drop back down to in 2019 and beyond. But everybody knew that. We told everybody that. But if you look at between 2017 to 2019, overall funding for K-12 education has gone up substantially. So there's been a very big increase in funding for K-12 education. Now, the problem is that you had, you know, some contract negotiations in there. And there's a wide range here locally from, I think, you know, 15% pay raises for in District 81 and Meade and Central Valley. But you've had, you know, other districts like Medical Lake and Cheney and Freeman's of the world that have had 7-8% increases, and they're not having the magnitude of budget problems in other places. And so those are, you know, separating the state from the local decision. That's not a state decision. I've not really commented or criticized on those local decisions. That's a decision of the local school boards and the local districts. But where I get a little bit defensive is when it gets pointed back to the state that we didn't provide the funding. We have. And so we're now kind of in this weird situation, I think, that we may be back into a pre-McCleary model where there's going to be an over-reliance on the local levies. We may find ourselves back in court and undoing all of the work and everything that's went into it. So that's the challenge and the conundrum we're in right now, and we'll wait and see, and hopefully I'm wrong and we won't get sued on a McCleary whatever 4.0 type of case coming down the line on this school funding.
So did you support the raise in the levy lid? I know we're getting into numbers that probably don't mean much to folks, but from $1.50 per $1,000 of assessed valuation, that's where it was after McCleary. The state's property taxes rose and the local property taxes dropped. So then the school districts went and said, hey, we need more of this local money again. So the legislature raised from $1.50 to $2.50. Did you and Jenny support that?
You know, I think both of us oppose that. And I will tell you, in that bill, there's some very problematic language. Like, it actually gives preferential treatment to districts on the west side of the Cascade. It says right in the law, and we can get you the, you know, the chapter and verse on that. It also has a special carve out for any school district with a student population above 40,000 students. So any guesses on how many students there are districts that is? That's one. It's Seattle School District. So the whole intent that we've heard about for years is that all students should have an equal opportunity regardless of their zip code. And that's not the case in what they did in that bill. And that's, to me, is deeply problematic. And to me, that is part of the reason why, when you have this disparate treatment, that it could open us up to lawsuits. So I voted no, and it didn't take me long to get to a no on that. And I don't know if Jenny wants to.
I voted no. The taxpayers made a promise, and that promise was broken. And you know, it came from also a situation where we started out with a surplus in our state funding. And, you know, we should actually be in a situation where people are getting some tax money back. So to have the taxes now that are going to be coming through, and now have this, not only that they're going to pay more property taxes, on top of things. But now we are possibly looking at another McCleary 2. It's not responsible. We can't keep going in the direction that we're going. We spend 51% of the state budget for K through 12 education. By 2022, it's going to be 53%. Reaching a point where how much is enough? Then that's when I was going to the doors. It did not matter whether a person was Democrat, Independent, or Republican. They all said, I do not want to pay any more taxes. They were adamant about that. So I feel that, you know, they were given a promise, and that promise should have been kept.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think there is just a tremendous amount of fatigue out there talking about public education funding. And this goes back for, the better part of a decade in fits and spurts, but it's really heated up in the last, 4 or 5 years on talking about that. And I think in the schools, I know the superintendents and the administrators are tired of this roller coaster model. The teachers certainly are, the students are, the parents are. There's another thing in this, which is, I don't know if we have time, but it's a pretty deep dive on, I don't know if you've been following the SEB. Sure. It's School Employee Benefits Board, where they created this whole benefit array. Well, that was supposed to, the impression we left with, it would be supposed to be something different than what it turned out to be. There's issues in there now that are really going to hurt the local districts, where a part-time employee gets full-time benefits if they reach a certain hour. And schools rely on a lot of retirees who want to drive bus in the morning for a couple hours, and everybody's happy. The retiree gets a little more money. But if they cross a certain point, they're now considered full-time. They have to pay these additional benefits, and they get double tap because even if the employee does not take the benefits, they still have to pay as if they were to the state. They have to pay money to the state to fund this, even if they're not drawing benefits. And a lot of these retirees or second career people may already have retirement or some sort of medical plan available to them. A lot of them are, in our region, military retirements, and they get the TRICARE through the military, and they don't need, the medical benefits. So I think maybe the intent is kind of okay, but I think the line is part-time employees get full-time benefits, gets really expensive, which means at the end of the day, there's going to be less part-time employment available to these folks, and a significant increase in cost to the districts, which is one of the big contributors to some of these budget problems. Mm-hmm. Is when you take a dive into that SEB and that benefit array now. So it's causing big problems.
We're talking about Washington's 2019 legislative session with Representatives Mike Volz and Jenny Graham from the 6th District. Another of the concerns was about special education funding, with a lot of the districts saying we don't get enough of what we need in order to be able to take care of the needs of special education students. You were talking on a video, I think the last day or the second to last day of the, and you were saying we hadn't dealt with this yet. How did it turn out?
Again, that was one of the bills. I think it went off the floor unanimously that we were all waiting for. If you would have asked me at the end of last year what would be the first thing, and I told people this, that we would come back and we would work on special ed, because I think there was a broad consensus that needed some work, and it really did. And all students means all students. And so it was at the very end, we finally got a bill through. We tried, the Republican caucus tried multiple times to get amendments on to fund that special education, in the operating budget and in a couple other places, trying to say, at least raise our hand and say, what about this? And eventually we did get something through. And I think in my conversation so far, I think it's been perceived as being helpful in a move in the right direction on getting that need addressed. And I don't think there was much disagreement that it wasn't something that should have been, in my opinion, near the top of the list, not what appeared to be an afterthought on the last weekend. I think it was kind of, the last 80 hours were a bit of a blur, but somewhere in there, I think we passed that special ed funding bill, which I think was a very positive thing.
So if we look ahead a year or two or three or four, when you talk with some of the superintendents and some of their financial people, they're a little worried about what their revenue situation is going to be. They're worried about if they're going to have to cut again next year. What are your thoughts going forward for education funding? Do you have the same those same worries that the state is going to be asked for more money or along that line?
I would say that I think that we need to take a look at the money, you know, how it's being spent, and just double check that things are, the money is going, you know, in programs that are working, that are not redundant at this point. And I think that the other thing that's important and that was a little disappointing was carving out the charter schools for the school funding. I don't agree with that. They're public schools, and those schools serve developmentally disabled people. They serve kids that are in poorer districts. And when you have public education, they all need to be included. And, you know, I mean, I think the average person can look at the fact that you get so much money and you have to, you know, I have to go and look for deals on things. I have to be really careful that if something is due, that there might be something that I'd love to be able to do, but I don't have the funding to be able to do that. So, you know, this is kind of one of those things that, you know, everybody wants more money. And there's a lot of people I know that work hard and they get paid, but a lot of people I know think they don't get paid enough. So that's something that's not unusual. And, you know, there comes a point in time where you have to live within your means, whatever it is you have to do to make it happen.
So I was following the Meade School District thing, and they were worried about, the parents were worried about, there were two programs especially that were cut, their alternative school, their alternative high school being moved back to Meade High School, and parents complaining, no, the whole reason this alternative school works is that we're away from the high school. And the second is their River Point Academy, kind of their STEM program, and they're saying, why do we have to give these things up that are so popular because it isn't considered basic education and funded by the state?
Yeah, that's right. I had, and I can't remember, some school administrator somewhere suggested to me that it's not necessarily about more money. It may be about more flexibility because, okay, deep in the weeds on this, and I won't get into too much minutia, there's a thing called the prototypical school model. And you start with the number of students, and the output tells you how many teachers, how many nurses, how many counselors you get, and janitors and administrators and the whole thing. And that's how the whole funding model is based. And as in some of these districts, they get the output might be like 0.04 or 4% of a counselor. Well, post that job that, you know, you work an hour and a half a week or whatever it is. So there's some big gaps in it. And it narrowly constrains the decision making at the local level.
So maybe going back to a point Jenny was making, is the idea or maybe the approach would be to change the flexibility so that more districts have the ability to spend more of that basic education money on things that are now not considered basic education?
Which, well, see, that's where you get into the fine line because of the intervention from the courts. And I've told people that the solution that we came up with, is it the best we can come up with? Well, no, it's the best we could come up with that the court would approve, which is a significant different than what's the best. And so the unfortunate part is the court's involvement in this, that in a perfect world that we would create this money with some broad categorical constraints on it under the definition of special ed. And I would certainly consider STEM, for example, a basic ed. And I think that we need to do a much better job of getting kids ready for, you know, a career and not just four-year university. And that's something Jenny and I both have been passionate about in this process. And I do think also not just in education, but if you look at how local governments are funded, it's always these very narrowly defined buckets that may or may not be appropriate for an individual district or an individual community. And so I think we got to kind of get away from the Olympia knows better, and we all get 200 IQs when we pull off of I-5 into Olympia. That's not the case. And a lot of these local school administrators, county commissioners, city officials might know a little bit more about their own communities. And they're all go through the same process that we do on the school board. You put a sign up and you go out and wave to people and you get elected and you're accountable to your constituent. Same with the commissioner or city council member. So
kind of in the, if you talk about the mushroom of education, one of the little things sort of on the fringe was the fact that you don't have to pass the WASL anymore. You don't have to pass the state test in order to be able to graduate. And that's going to happen for what, class of 2020?
2021 or 2020. I can't remember which one.
So are you both, what do you both think about that?
Well, it's not going to be eliminated altogether. They are they're recognizing that not everybody is stamped from the same cookie cutter. You have some kids maybe that have developmental needs. You've got maybe another child that has to leave school and go to a job because they've got to take care of their families. So, and not everybody is great at taking a test. Maybe they need to demonstrate that they know how to do what's required in a different way. So there should be some flexibility. That was one of the bills that came through our committee for college and workforce development. And we had a lot of conversations about that. So, I think that there's progress there.
Yeah, I've been, since I've been there, I've been on the K-12 Ed Committee, and I've been supportive of the delinking the standardized testing from graduation. And, I mean, you can have a kid with a 3.5 GPA that doesn't graduate high school. And so what this bill did, and I've worked with the primary sponsor and others and signed off on multiple versions of the bill. I was going to run my own bill that did it, but there were so many options to choose from. I figured I would get in the boats and help row rather than build my own boat. But we finally did get something through that created multiple pathways to graduate rather than just one test, one size fits all. And I think that was huge progress. And I think it's we've overemphasized a single test. I mean, the most egregious case I heard about was there was this young lady who came and testified who took Running Start in high school for her last 2 years, was on the dean's list at a community college, had an AA degree, and couldn't graduate high school. I mean, that alone tells you something's flawed in the system. And it's unfortunate we can't go back in time and help her or the others that were in that boat. But at least going forward, they will have different avenues of getting through high school and getting that diploma, still meeting tough, rigorous standards, still have to take the test. Just if you don't pass the test, there might be other ways, like SAT or ACT, for example, is a pretty tough test. So I think it's a good positive move.
Jenny Graham and Mike Voltz are the representatives in the Washington State House of Representatives from the 6th District. Both are Republicans. We'll spend the next 6 podcasts meeting candidates for Spokane City Council in the Northeast District. That's District 1. You can find the podcast by searching for Inland Journal in Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page of the Spokane Public Radio website. Send your comments and story ideas to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. We're glad you joined us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.